Native Circles, a podcast for Indigenous experiences and conversations, which are shared within a circle of respect, trust, and compassion.
Hi, welcome to the first episode of Native Circles. I'm Sarah Newcomb, Tsimshian of the First Nations. I'm a writer, blogger, and freelance editor currently residing in Dallas, Texas.
Hi, this is Farina King. I'm She'e Bilagana Nishle, Do Kia'ani Bashish Chin, Bilagana Dashache, Do Sinijini, Dashanale, Akot Egoatsa Nishle. I shared my clans. I am of white English American settler descent on my mother's side, and I am born for the Towering House Clan and Blackstreet Woods people of Dene. And that's how we call ourselves, of Navajo Nation.
Well, I thought we would start out with kind of what inspired the name of our podcast, Native Circles, because we bounced around a lot of different names. But the second we said circles, like, both of us were kind of stuck on it, because it means, circles tend to mean a lot in different Indigenous groups, even though we all have different societies and different cultures and traditions. Circles have a lot of meaning, and yeah, that for me drew me in. I know you talked about different parts of what the circles represented to you. Can you talk about that?
Mm-hmm. So a little background too, of Sarah and I were talking about this podcast primarily from a group of scholars, community members, and intellectuals who were committed to Indigenous-based research and history. And so when we were trying to think about a podcast that could help to educate and publicize some of those hard-pressing conversations that we were having in trusted circles of our colleagues and friends, who, like I said, had these connections with Native American and Indigenous communities, circles hit the spot, because we were thinking about how a lot of Indigenous peoples have very cyclical mentalities, epistemologies, and views on the world compared to linear processes that have been imposed upon, especially in dynamics of settler colonialism. So this relationality, the interconnectedness that circles embody, it resonated with us, because all human beings, whether they're conscious of it or not, we're immersed in this world, of many worlds that overlap, interconnect with human beings and non-human beings, and we influence and shape each other as an individual, but inseparable from all the different beings in our surroundings. So there's cyclical ways of thinking about time and history and of narrative, telling stories and truth seeking, and then also seasons of life and nature, and all these things matter, and they really come to the front in our thought processing and conversations that were inspired from the circle of friends and intellectuals that were regularly meeting, especially during COVID-19 pandemic, when there was so much isolation and distancing. It was our way of staying in our circles and having reciprocity, supporting each other, exchanging ideas that we realize matter not only to each of us personally, as Sarah and I have these ties to Indigenous communities. I'm not only a citizen of the Navajo Nation and have my kin, my family that I'm connected to, but I also am a associate professor of Native American history. So I try to meet and connect with community members and community, not just members, right? Different peoples all the time. And we're all learning from each other and such. So that's what made me really think about it.
Yeah. And there was so much visual, like when we talked about circles, I was immediately just very visually picturing so many different things with that. I saw circles of friends, circles of family, you know, pictured hands holding, but also like the dancing in my community, the drumming, the spirituality. Like there was so many meanings to circles for me that, and just the interconnectedness of that shared history that we all have with each other, even with us being different tribes or different nations. There's so much connectedness in how we have that compassion for each other. We have that love for each other. We have that, you know, drive to make those spaces of truth telling and of compassion and trust and respect. So yeah, I was very visual when we talked about the names, you know, talking about Native circles, I got very visual with it. So I was excited about that. But yeah, when you mentioned like some of the conversations that we've had during the pandemic, that you created, you know, this like online group to have these type of conversations. And I, attending those, like felt that connectedness, and hearing the different experiences and different points of view were so, you know, enriching. And that was one of the things that kind of motivated, I know, with developing the podcast, is I kept saying, oh my gosh, this would be amazing when you put it out there. And you kept saying, yeah, you know, like you were always talking about wanting to get it on a bigger platform so people could hear these conversations. So yeah, this is pretty exciting. And the other thing that I think would be worth like kind of just talking about for a second is, for me, growing up with Native American heritage, I was always aware of history. Like I always was aware of the things that my people went through, and what other tribes went through. The older I got, the more I read. So I was very aware, but there was also this other side of me that was very avoidant of history because it was so hard. Like it was so hard to read. And I'd read, especially my teen years, I'd read and I'd put it down and be like, okay, I'm done. And you know, like I would just go live after that. And so during these years of me kind of starting to read more and talk about history more and current events and getting more involved, it was almost like an accident because like I'd avoided it for so long. But there's also that passion of wanting to give voice to these issues, wanting to speak out and do my part. And so I wanted to know kind of like where that was, kind of like my journey. What kind of led you into working in this field and like that passion? Because growing up Indigenous, we are aware of it, but that doesn't mean we necessarily, you know, are driven that on that path. What kind of led you in this way?
Yeah. That answer is my life story in many ways. I relate to that so much, Sarah, of I think this is at the heart of why we want to do this podcast, why we're taking our time. And there's a lot of podcasts out there, a lot of different voices already, but I am just constantly affronted by the covering up of Native American histories and how it has shook me, just like you said, the pain, but also my yearning to know what my ancestors and my family, my own father, my parents, of course, my mother and father and their relationship, my siblings, my aunts and uncles. I mean, these are those family connections. For me, that's where it really began, was just even trying to understand my own family history and dynamics. And little by little, these stories that were tragic, but also empowering. These are our empowering stories. When we learn what we've been through and that we, like me, I wouldn't exist if it were not for the resilience, perseverance, and strength of my ancestors and my family. And that's something very personal, but what I learned is it also helps and connects with anyone if they open their heart and their mind to learn. And it strengthens all of us when we learn how to listen to other stories rather than try and silence them and extinguish them. And that's something about Native American and Indigenous peoples, is so many of them, including my people, my family, and our experiences, they have been targeted. Whether you can call it intentional or not, you know, that's case by case basis, as there's larger processes at play that people are even, in a way, unconsciously complacent and complicit with, because they think inaction isn't anything. They think omission or ignorance, you know, is their free ticket away from any accountability or responsibility for the destruction and violence of some of these processes that some people do benefit from and have advantages from. But when any one of us are suffering, we're all suffering. And I know that's true because I am fortunate. I've grown up with a lot of privilege, and I'm grateful for the honors in my life to be able to carry stories of people who have experienced so many things to me that are almost unimaginable. Like my own father, my own mother, I can't even imagine what they went through. But I'm grateful to carry these stories because I know the violence still happens and affects us every day. That I have family who worry about a roof caving over their head, or they worry about their children not being attacked because they are Dene, or a Dene woman, that, you know, how they're going to be treated. And they face this to this day, a slow, almost, you know, inconspicuous violence and attack on them. And it's tied to history of the continuities and perpetuation of violence. And people think, might say, history is past, get over it. But we're not over it. And the people who say that reveal their cards that they're not over it. Because if they were really over it, they would actually say, yeah, let's move on and have a better future. Think of the 7 generations ahead.
Yeah, history is still taught. Like, it's still something that we're always learning about. But what history we're taught is control. So some history, like shoving some history and saying, oh, we're not going to talk about that because it's in the past. But then taking another bit of history and saying, oh, this is from the past, we're going to talk about it. That's actually the problem, is history doesn't have to be this us against them, or this, yeah, it doesn't have to be this shaming space or this silenced space. That's actually what makes history harder to deal with, is by silencing parts of it. Mm-hmm. But when we just openly discuss all parts of history, like, okay, this is all history, let's not pick and choose, let's just talk about it, let's just get to know it, so that everybody has an understanding of all our history, not just these little parts that we're going to highlight, and then we're going to come over here and we're going to silence these other parts. Because what that does is it silences certain groups. And it's that silencing that can kind of, I don't know what word I'm looking for, it can kind of just double down. It doubles the, you know, that experience is just kind of perpetuated of being silenced is like that experience of not being heard. I'm not articulating the right word. It's on the tip of my tongue, but
it's like a defensive mechanism of, and I think power is a key part of that. There's been a lot of scholarship dialogue about power, but something you said, Sarah, made me think about how this context of we're in 2021, as we're launching this podcast, there's debates about critical race theory and censorship of history. And so those are certainly political, but it's more than even politics. It's people's lives. And for some people, these are not questions about comfortable and uncomfortable conversations, but also about safety. When people feel safe, are they putting their necks out there and at risk? The other thing to keep in mind is that history is so complicated, and that's what we're going to get into, the messiness of it, and I'm excited for that. But there are some stories that Indigenous peoples want to protect for themselves because they have been, their knowledge has been extracted and exploited, not only their bodies and lands, but also knowledge. And so we are certainly going to respect that and uphold that. And I think, you know, there's the difference. Yeah, there's these differences in also what we mean in these various contexts of seeking to have these conversations that are open and safe about history and addressing these heavy power dynamics that are suppressive and censoring certain histories at the expense of others, or they see it as an end game, you know, like it's some kind of game and dynamics. When I'm emphasizing we're all connected, and that's what I love about circles with this. And we bring in Native circles can teach us all something, and they want to. We want to highlight those voices that want to share and help people to see our relationality and interconnectedness, and that we still can celebrate beauties and the uniqueness of all our lives and matters, but we can be building relationships that are positive and synergy, and we're stronger together. We are happier when we're together and see that. That's what really has inspired me in all this.
Yeah, that's beautiful. So, which kind of sets up for what we wanted to talk about today, which was what's in the current news with boarding schools. And one of the things that I noticed that just kept coming back to me, which comes back to kind of how we're talking about silencing stories, silencing history, is the Native communities knew there were lots of children that never returned. The Native communities knew the abuses that happened. But it's like having it all public all of a sudden, and no one can turn away from it now. It's like, here's the proof. We weren't making it up. These are the stories we've been telling. I kept thinking about the people that went through it that were silenced, that have been telling this, but nothing happened, that were speaking out about their experiences, but were just kind of, brushed aside. Nobody really talked about it. And that just kind of made me ache. But this whole, you know, experience of seeing all of this in the news just kind of opens up, you know, that those kind of wounds with how difficult history can be, but also wanting to be supportive and driven to make change, to speak out. Like the first thing I did, I went and bought an orange t-shirt and I'm not a good artist, but I was like, I'm doing this. And I did kind of my Cynthian art and did 215 designs on the wings of a bird, and wrote 215, and I went and ran 2 miles, 2.15 miles. But like, I'm getting my shirt out again over and over, and I'm adding, you know, all these kids, and it's just, it's emotional. But it was the only thing I knew to do. Like, it was the only thing I could do to process was to run and think about them. But as you've been watching the news and you know, you've heard so many stories, especially with this being like a major focus of your work. Like, can you talk about what you've experienced and some of the research you've done, or what, where you're at with everything too?
Yeah, thank you, Sarah, for, you know, motioning to an inspiration as well of getting this podcast kickstarted. Yeah. We had been going back and forth talking about it for some time. We're like,
yeah, pause. We just kept pausing. We're like, oh, in a month. Oh, in 2 months. We're just so busy. Well,
yeah, life and happening. Well, all the all the demands that we're balancing, and finally this kicked us in the pants. I mean, it really did. It hit me. It struck me. Similar to what you were sharing, because of, for me, boarding school stories surrounded me my whole life, maybe even before I was conscious of it or not, since my father went to the Rhema Indian Boarding School in New Mexico, and pieces here and there I would hear about his experiences, how he tried running away from the boarding school, that he was sent there as a small boy when he was only 5 years old. He was dropped off without any warning by his parents. And he hardly had seen any white people at all growing up in those early years. And he didn't speak English. He hadn't even seen a toilet. So that always, that story stuck with me of how he said, I never had seen a toilet. He tried to take it apart, and they punished him for that. They punished him for that curiosity. And only recently, just about, I don't know, within a year or so, he even shared more details of how he was crying and all the children were crying in the dorm room. Their first night. Just wails, you know, in the whole room. And a dorm attendant had started singing a song. She sang a Christian song. I can't remember if it was in Navajo or not. In my memory, I believe she was singing it in Navajo because he understood it. And that, you know, imagine coming in and not knowing this foreign language that they're yelling at you, and they're yelling at you because you don't know how to use a toilet or whatever. And it comforted him. It was the first time he had heard about Jesus. Now, the complicity and the destruction of churches, the havoc wreaked on Indigenous families and communities, churches have been a key partner in that and perpetrator of that. The residential schools in Canada, many of those were orchestrated by churches. But it, again, shows a complexity of this. My father shared that story as a part of his testimony in Christianity. But there's this cognitive dissonance as well, right? That Christianity was used to justify this attack on innocent children and to perpetuate violence against Indigenous peoples. But then individuals like my father found it as hope and inspiring in very dark moments of his life. And so many times I would hear stories like that, whatever you call it, cognitive dissonance, like things just didn't make sense in my head for me, in my experience. And I wanted to understand it. I wanted to know more. I wanted to understand it because even in simple, what might come across as simple things when I was a child, like how I couldn't speak Dene Bazad. I didn't know the Navajo language. And when my family would have reunions, gatherings, that was the language of our parents. My dad would speak Navajo with his siblings. unfortunately, I didn't really get to know my Nollies, my paternal grandparents, or any grandparents well, because they had all passed away by the time I was young. And that's another story, right, of how they passed away and all these different dynamics. And so for me, it was like connecting dots of why didn't I speak Navajo? Why was that a language that only my father would speak with the family? That my father was not the only one to go to boarding school, but uncles, aunts, cousins, so many. And in Native American and Indigenous communities, including Alaska Natives, schooling experiences like that, boarding school experiences, as historian Brenda Child has called it, is a metaphor among Native American communities. Boarding schools as a metaphor, it's something that now almost is a definitive, like defines Native American experiences. It's a very defining part of these experiences that a lot of us can relate to, that we're not far removed from, even if we went to boarding school or not, that intergenerational connection too, that has been tied up with what people have openly and been studying as intergenerational trauma.
I was reading about how not a single Native American alive is not connected to the boarding school experience, whether it was them, their parent, or their grandparent. Like, there was somebody close to them, you know, relationally, that experienced boarding school. So it's very much, it is part of our history. It shouldn't be silenced. And we're still feeling the effects of it. Like, there's so much that impacted our community. One of the things you talked about with your dad and how, you know, you were trying to make sense of, well, here's these stories, but I also see how he holds onto this spirituality of comfort. That's one of the things where I just kept feeling like, and this is for years, I felt this way, is we don't know what somebody's experience is and where they hold on to some form of balance or peace for the trauma they experience. Like, they survived. Mm-hmm. They survived the best way they could with what they could. Mm-hmm. And so many people don't realize that Native Americans did not have religious freedom. I was a year old. It was 1978 when the Religious Freedom Act for American Indians was put in place. And even then, it still didn't grant us true religious freedom. Mm-hmm. So what our older generations experienced, I have so much compassion for. And like, he survived and he found peace and balance in the only way he could. And yeah, I saw the same with some of my family and community. And instead of focusing on, oh, you know, how could they embrace this thing that destroyed them? I'm like, they survived. They found balance. And as we talk about history and we don't turn away from it, we talk about their stories and we share their stories. There's also this movement that is so beautiful right now of us reclaiming our languages and reclaiming our mm-hmm. spiritual traditions. And yeah, I've been trying to learn Smongfax, which is my Tsimshian language. And that's so difficult because I don't have anybody to talk to. And my grandma was the last generation. Very few. There's new generation of people reviving the language, but finding that balance of accepting what our older generations held on to like survive and being proud of them, and also celebrating, like re-embracing our Indigenous culture, spirituality, and identities. It doesn't have to be either or. It's like, it's just that kind of that circular idea of we're all connected and we're moving in the right direction mm-hmm. with our ancestors' history, with how they survived, and we're going to keep going.
Yeah, I think that all these stories inspired me to become a historian, have really propelled me in life. I've grown so much because I'm learning about the experiences of my family. And it's not, again, it's not something that's just past, right? Of, okay, I acknowledge it. I know it. I'm processing it. But now what, right? Of what are my family's challenges today? If they're struggling in an area that was mined for uranium and the water was contaminated, and then there's proposals to reopen those uranium mines. I mean, we're talking recent stuff. Their lives matter, that land and their connection to land, which again, the boarding school is a key part of that assimilationist approach to education, was cutting off Indigenous identity that was inseparable from connections to their homeland. And that, you know, was the threat of Indigenous sovereignty and epistemologies in education, was the contestations over land. White settler colonialism became this machine of devouring land and seeing it for resource extraction, or dispossessing Native Americans, removing them. This is where, if anybody might learn anything about Native American history, they have heard of the Trail of Tears, but they think of just that one event. No, there were series of removals, and the boarding school system was a part of that process. It was another genocidal approach to getting rid of Native Americans, even if it was, and in some cases it was physical, whether it was putting the students in crowded spaces where pandemics, like we're seeing how COVID-19 is disproportionately ravaging Native Americans, including Navajo Nation, which has been hit hardest than any other people in the world, arguably. It has been comparable. And I lost my aunt, who was a boarding school survivor. She survived boarding school, but then she was a fighter her whole life. A gentle fighter too. Like, she wasn't necessarily an activist putting out at protests and such, but she was caring for the children, being the grandmother and caring for her grandchildren and all these children. And that to her was her resistance, because she was sustaining family ties that were jeopardized for her, you know, that were threatened for her from her parents because she went to boarding school, you know. And everyone has all these very specific stories. And so my first book, The Earth Memory Compass, I tried very much to think in terms of a Dene cyclical way of thinking and compass and approach in looking at specifically Native Dene boarding school experiences in Navajo Nation, within the four sacred mountains that mark our homelands. These boarding schools were not just off reservation, sending students thousands of miles away, but some of them were separated by the walls of a boarding school right on their homeland. Like, it was an invasion, you know, that way. And Navajos still struggle, like many other Indigenous peoples, over educational sovereignty, different forms of sovereignty, but certainly over education. Who has authority over the schools? Who sets the curriculum? This goes back to some of our initial conversations of why this podcast matters, why we're having these conversations. Why are people arguing over the education of the children, of youth? Because it shapes our leaders. It shapes our future. And there's some in power who like the status quo. They like perpetuating these legacies of settler colonialism that are very destructive, but also for some people puts them, they see themselves on top of it. But I say that comes at a cost. They're sacrificing so much. You know, they are not really happy in my mind. You know, that idea of also, what is wealth? What is success? Schools say, you know, they're trying to prepare successful American citizens. But what does that mean? How do we measure that? And Indigenous communities have so many ways of showing that. Even as I'm talking about these debates of climate change, environment, right, relating to uranium mining and those issues, at least in Navajo country, we're worried about all these fires, droughts. How do we live with the land? How do we survive, all of us?
And what are our children going to inherit?
Yeah, what are our children going to inherit? The seven generations.
I
was going to say, I feel like some people want to just stick their head in the sand, you know, live it up right now and not worry about that. I think this pandemic has really opened up some eyes to our vulnerabilities, all of us, no matter who you are.
And I think sometimes like that idea of embracing all history can feel threatening because a lot of it is extremely hard to accept, but that's simply history. Like if we could get to a space where we can all just talk openly about history and move forward together, it doesn't have to be a threatening space. It can be a forward motion of what would be better, what would be good for all people. Like all children are gonna inherit whatever we leave behind, and having open conversations and being accepting of different paths while not silencing vulnerable groups.
Yeah, I think you also brought up, that's so awesome that you got the t-shirt on and running. You know, there's so many ways to heal, even when it is taking care of your body, the spirit that you're doing that in. And that was, you know, as everyone's coming to this realization of unmarked graves, that like my friend Preston McBride in his dissertation writes about a lethal education. There were children mass graves unmarked that was literally covered up history, right? Covered up stories and experiences. I was even reading just the other day in my work, as I'm working on an upcoming book about the Intermountain Indian Boarding School, which was the largest federal Indian boarding school in the United States. It opened in the 1950s, specifically for Navajos. So this is not long, long ago either. These are people, the survivors, people are alive today. And it's a balance as well of they don't want to be thought of only as victims. They did do what they could to seek joy in their life, to have reprieve, you know, to have posterity. And they also, you know, that sense of guilt that everyone feels if you're a survivor, if you don't, you know, I don't know, whatever vantage point, wherever you're coming from, guilt and this discomfort, whatever we talk about, the pain of learning these difficult histories, I think that those feelings were meant to have them to grow and strengthen. It's okay to have them, but then it's what you do now, right? Are we supporting Navajo Nation in reclaiming their education? Are we supporting the survivors by giving them these spaces to share their stories? Are we acknowledging that they're suffering trauma like PTSD, like anyone else? Or are we saying, you know, get over it? We don't see that.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the things that also like motivated me with doing the podcast together. Like I was like, okay, what do I want to accomplish with this? What is motivating me? What's going to keep me going? And I know for you, you have that passion for education, like educating people about all of this and truth telling. And I really relate to that. And one of the things that I felt really strongly about with sharing these stories, with putting things out there, was I would love to accomplish or see greater respect between all peoples, you know, and I also wanted to see compassion grow from all peoples, you know, that no matter what somebody's heritage or background was, that they could listen to these stories or listen to the knowledge that we share or that other people share and just have respect and have that growing compassion, because silence is a form of abuse. Mm-hmm. And silencing children, one saying that I absolutely have always hated, but I know was a big part of boarding schools, was kill the Indian to save the man. And I'm like, okay, we're talking adults there. No, these are children, and not all of them even survived. You know, so many died, but they were basically killing the spirit of children to save them, but it was doing the opposite. They weren't saving them. They were simply just killing the spirit of those children. And growing, like you said, so many carry PTSD, so many carry that trauma, and we can educate as much as we want. But what I hope comes out of it is just that space for people to feel safe to come in, not knowing anything about history or not knowing, you know, these stories, and be like, okay, I don't know anything, but I'm here. You know, I'm like, okay, that's awesome. Because I have Tsingtsian heritage. There's so much that I didn't know until recently, you know, just 4 or 5 years of me reading more openly, not avoiding history. I'm like, I didn't know.
Our own children don't.
Our own children. Yeah. And there's no shame in that, but having that space where people can feel safe to say, I don't know, you know, let me just listen.
Yeah.
And then not expecting people to go back and change history. We can't, but creating that space to say, okay, that's history. I'm not going to deny it. I'm not going to ignore it. I'm going to have compassion for the people that have survived this and that are still trying to survive it and are still trying to create change or create those safe spaces. And that's why it's important not to silence history. It's not about protecting someone else's identity or making them feel unsafe. Like when we share our history, it's not about trying to threaten somebody else's part in history.
Yeah.
That's not what it's about. It's about just having respect and having compassion to move forward, you know, like to have that forward motion, be like, okay, that happened. Wow. You know, let's create those healing spaces, but also through lots of education, lots of acknowledgement and listening to those stories. And yeah. So like, I'm always in a place of, okay, what don't I know now? You know, like, and wanting to hear the stories. Yeah. So
there's so many opportunities, so much work out there. I'm trying to work with my friend, Marsha Small, a Northern Cheyenne knowledge keeper who has been using ground penetrating radar to find unmarked graves. She did significant work at the Chamawa Indian boarding school where my own uncle, one of my own uncles and aunts worked there as a dorm attendant. So I also want us to embrace an approach. There are going to be so many stories about this too. There is need for museums, research centers, support research in this. We have Deb Holland's Federal Indian Boarding School Truth Initiative. Who is she hiring? What are the approaches she's taking? And Marsha really wants to hone in on that, the protocols. Are they working with tribal nations and communities? Are they respecting indigenous approaches? She's been critical, as others have, of even the great strides that Canada has paved with their truth and reconciliation commission and all the work they've done. But we can learn from that. Did they work hand in hand, shared authority with First Nations, and even in how they were approaching and applying technologies that are more accessible today, you know, digitizing oral histories, or if they are mapping these found unmarked graves and trying to figure all that out. This is all very still sensitive, and are we honoring and respecting indigenous sovereignties and epistemologies, ways of knowing and also healing and grieving? But then, as you brought up, for survivors or individuals, they may not even call themselves survivors, some of them. Some former boarding school students I have met have even been proud and nostalgic of their time at boarding school. And I am not going to just label them as brainwashed or whatever. Again, like you said, it's compassion.
Everyone has different experiences, different ways of coping and different ways of surviving. And
yeah. Empathy. What's their story? Can I listen to them and honor their life? That it's not saying they didn't have hardship. Even some of those people who are proud of their stories, I mean, proud of their time at boarding school, they tell me how they had to clean a bathroom with a toothbrush. They were punished severely at times, and the message hit them of their culture and language being belittled or sanitized in some way. So they did have these very difficult dynamics to navigate as children and youth we all face. But so I think it's that balancing and honoring and trying to see, as you said, this isn't just either or. I appreciate you pointing that out, the exclusiveness of these stories. But for instance, there are boarding school alumni who have strong associations. They have reunions, they gather. There's all kinds of organizations in the Phoenix area where there was the Phoenix Indian Boarding School. They opened a community center with the Native connections in the Phoenix Indian Urban Center, collaborated to open a community center for Native American and Indigenous peoples in the Phoenix Indian Legacy Center in downtown Phoenix. That was incredible. And yet, you know, we need to support their programs there. That's where they can have language revitalization and vitality exercises and community gatherings, where they can have support Indigenous food sovereignty with Indigenous food labs. And I'm hoping that Brigham City can do something like that, where the grounds of this major boarding school, it was formerly a military hospital. So keep in mind how students probably feared haunting, or how they viewed that in Native cultures of Navajos, at least. It's taboo to go to a cemetery if you do not go through the proper ceremonies and protocols. And so they did that, but they razed down most of that school, the school grounds and buildings. But the Intermountain has strong alumni gatherings, and they're planning one for fall of 2021 with the intertribal students who went there, and they're looking for funding and support. There's not even a clear-cut mechanism for them to have, you know, these gatherings, which is networking, community building. That's a part of healing. That's healing,
yeah,
too.
Yeah. That's amazing that they're getting together, and yeah, that creates a space of healing with people that you don't have to explain. You don't have to detail what you went through. They just get it, and you're in this safe space of where are you now, and strengthening each other and supporting each other. Yeah, it sounds like there's a lot of places where people could go to offer support, or just educating yourself. Like, there's lots of ways that people listening could like navigate, like, well, what do I do? Like, this is sad, this is horrible, but so often even I feel helpless. You know, I'm just like, I don't know what to do. And I was feeling that pain of the communities. And so I just ran, you know, I drew on my t-shirt and ran. But for those listening, I think there's a lot of areas where they could, books they could read or stories they could listen to, and just to be open to just hearing someone else's experience.
Yeah. And I wanted to say there's also the Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition. And they've been doing great work, doing expansive research projects, all kinds of events, multimedia resources, educational resources. They've been a key partner with different entities, especially now with the backing of the Secretary of Interior and that department in moving forward on an investigation. So check their website out, and you can always use that support. And there's different schools and projects, like Carlisle has an incredible digital archive, and they've had initiatives to try and create a space. Where's a museum space or such? And I went to visit Carlisle once. It's on a military base. And where the gravesite was, it was removed at a point. It was moved, transitioned, and placed by a commissary and by an open road. And I felt, you know, even concerned about that. You know, there's questions. And even on the Carlisle site, there's not a museum space to this. They have one because it was a historic military base, like even dating back, I believe, to the Revolutionary era. You'll have to check it. This is off the top of my mind. But they have something for that, but not even you know, really a full space to Carlisle there, which was notorious, but also important to so many lives and families of boarding school students. As you quoted Richard Henry Pratt, who was seen as one of the key designers mm-hmm. of assimilation, as historian David Wallace Adams has called it, education for extinction. And there's been so many mentors, Chanina Loma Waima, I referred to Brenda Child, Margaret Jacobs. In history, there's so many, I can't even name them all. There's great works coming out still, different edited volumes, Matthew Sakestua Gilbert, his work in looking at Hopi education, all these experiences. So there are resources out there that people need to read. They need to be sharing them. And the Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition, they've been sharing them too. So that's a great hub. And there's the Genoa Reconciliation Project of the Genoa Indian School. I've heard of Stewart Indian School. So there are different projects. The Chilaco Indian Boarding School had an oral history project. They made a documentary. And there is so much more to be doing and helping to not only have it be done, but that people are accessing it, that they're learning from it.
Yeah, that's amazing. I'm so happy to hear that there's that much work being done and that people will have places to go to learn about it or to help offer or hear this side of history.
Yeah, I'm so, as you can tell, you can talk about so many different areas of this, and I'm passionate, and I am hopeful that we will have more episodes bringing in other guests, some who I even, you know, quoted, and learn from more about all this great work happening. Just as my Uncle Albert told me, you know, look for that child in you. Like, this is why it's that cycle again, right? Of what you brought up, Sarah, of we all were children. We all start as children. We're learning. And my uncle said, return to that child, turn to that child again. And others say, you know, we're looking for those voices of the children, and they teach us so much when we can listen to the children. And in Navajo teachings, it's Sa-Nagai-Bik-Eh-Hajon is so central. It's been translated as walk in beauty, but it is very cyclical in the sense of there will always be disruption, challenges, hardships to beauty. And it's a cycle of restoring that balance and harmony. And it doesn't end. It's, my father's called it a whirlwind, but that's not something to be afraid of. You know, I think that linear mindset is like, put an end to it. It's done, over, move on. You know, your beginning end, but this is an ongoing cycle, and that's the beauty of it. That is the beauty of it.
Which makes me think of your aunt that passed away. She definitely had compassion and an understanding of just the children because of what she experienced. And I'm sorry to hear that she passed away, but she left just such a beautiful legacy and story. And that idea of, like when we reach and tap into our inner child or reach back into who we are, that child, as a mother, you know, as an aunt, as a friend, you know, that's so much what has motivated me in my work is just children. And so when you were talking about her, I wanted to stop you in that moment because I was just like, wait, let's talk about her for a bit, because she was a survivor. And what did she focus on? She was definitely like absolute warrior, with how she focused completely on the children of the family. And that's how I've seen in my family that's what my grandma was to me, mm-hmm. is the more the younger a child is, the more they need, the more you respect, the younger the child, the more respect you show. So the elders, that it's not about being old that makes someone an elder. It's not respect that they demand. It's how much our elders give to the children and it, and to those upcoming generations. That's what creates that, that respect from the younger generation. It's not a demanding thing. It is a circular thing. And then we go on, we've learned that, and we go on and pass it on to the next generation of children. And so much of that is connecting to our own childhood too.
Yeah, thank you so much for saying that, because what you just said, it really touched me. You mentioned the word warrior, and it is a very complicated term because it has been appropriated in a stereotyped way that has been detrimental. And so it's always, you know, there's always within these different words, different debates and such. But when we think of what is a warrior, you just really touched me on that, because in Diné teachings, a warrior is someone who reminds people we belong to the same family. And they take care of the sick and the hungry. And they serve, in a sense, right? And yeah, many people can relate to that, but you know, it gets hijacked by especially hyper masculinity or different aspects and such. I don't know if I told you about this, because we've had lots of conversations before, but and as well among Diné, we name our women warrior names.
I didn't know that.
Bah, yeah. And my aunt, they called her Nanaba, which meant she returns from war. And so that really stuck with me, because I wanted to name my daughter with Ba, is that signifier of a woman warrior. And I did. And I had my baby girl when I was in my doctoral studies at Arizona State University. And I seriously was at the end of a semester, and I had her and went back to class right after having her. And I brought her into class one day to introduce her to the class. She was just so small. And they were asking about her name. And I told her her name and what it meant, and that it had warrior, a signifier of that in the name. Well, actually, someone had asked, did Navajo women, were they warriors? Were they actually in the raids or a part of that? And he like made a laugh out loud, you know, smirked and said, no, they weren't. It hit me of how automatically dismissive he was of that. And he thought in his mindset, you know, this is what warrior meant, and that would exclude women. And he wasn't trying to understand that this was an ancestral practice and tradition dating back since time immemorial, right? Going back. And so there's clearly something there of women's roles and in society, how they're viewed and their part. And as I shared with my aunt, it was really powerful for me when she passed away, thinking about her name, that she had been through a war of her own, in her own way, of different challenges that she faced.
But it was like how she reacted. That's where I see that warrior. Mm-hmm. It's not about, like, to me, it's almost like saying, I'm not going to swear. So even though that would kind of capture it, like, she was just powerful. That's a good word to use, powerful. Like, that's how I see the word warrior when it's attributed to women. Like, how many powerful women ensured the survival of their children, of their people, of their communities? It wasn't always about going to war against someone else. It was being a warrior and, like, powerful. Like, the way certain words translate, so much of the meaning can be kind of lost. So if there's that tradition of calling women the warriors, it's almost like they're calling them powerful in who they are. And yeah, that's all I could see when you shared about her, was like, powerful.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned that too, because a lot of our conversations on this podcast, I think, and what many people talk about are these power struggles, right? Of what's empowering for some, who do we recognize as powerful, and the impacts that people have in lives and the world. So I'm just so excited for this conversation. As you can tell, we can go in a lot of directions. Thank you, Sarah, for
This has been great.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think this is a good start. We definitely covered a lot, and it's almost like it was a just like not even a drop in the bucket.
I know, and we will have more opportunities to talk to people and have people reach out to us. We want to hear, want to pay attention to what are, you know, these, again, pressing conversations, even if they're the kinds that, like with Indian residential and boarding schools, these are conversations we've been having our whole lives in ways or other, in some way or another, right?
Yes. Yeah.
That it's, as people say, past time, ready or not, let's face this. So
thank you for that.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for everybody that listened and joined us for our first episode of Native Circles. And it should be an adventure as we figure out podcasting.
Yes, stay tuned.
Doing this all. But we'll see you next time. Thank you.
Thanks.